Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Among Republicans, Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, a decorated Vietnam veteran, is the leading critic of the Iraq War and one of the GOP's most trenchant and independent voices on foreign policy. He considered an 08 White House run, but that is off the table now, and he's decided to leave the Senate. But it's hard to imagine Chuck Hagel leaving the public arena. In a new, hard-hitting book, he's asking tough questions about his country's future. This hour on Point, Senator Chuck Hagel on war, politics, and America's direction. Joining me now from New York City is Chuck Hagel, a two-term Republican senator from Nebraska. He sits on the Foreign Affairs, Banking, and Intelligence Committees. He earned two Purple Hearts in the Vietnam War, serving in the Army alongside his brother Tom. A fourth-generation Nebraskan, he's a former businessman and investment banker. He attracted a lot of attention last year when he flirted with the run for the White House, and he also briefly thought about a third-party bid with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He plans to retire from the Senate in January. His new book now is America, Our Next Chapter. Senator Hagel, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Jane, thank you very much.
So much to talk about, so many fascinating aspects of your book and your personal story, and we'll get to it all. But I want to start with two big issues facing America right now, the economy and Iraq. Senator, as you know, heavy fighting is erupting throughout Iraq now, and militia and insurgent attacks are increasing. What is behind this? What do you make of it?
Well, I think we go back to the beginning, and the beginning was when we invaded Iraq in March of 2003, when we did not think through the consequences of taking Saddam Hussein out of power, and then who was going to govern after Saddam was gone, and what role America would have in that. We didn't think through those tough issues, and consequently we are today where we are. This is not a battle against al-Qaeda as the front in our war against terrorists. Just as you noted, what's going on in Iraq today is part of a civil war that has been up and down over the last 6 years between Shia and Sunni, and what we're seeing now in Basra in the southern part of Iraq is a manifestation of the Shia warlords who are taking on the government of Prime Minister Maliki. And what we've seen in the western part of Iraq the last 2 years has been essentially an accommodation with the Sunnis based on our payments to over 90,000 so-called awakening freedom fighters that we pay $300 a month to. We've essentially ethnically divided Baghdad. The Kurds are in the north playing their own game. And so this is all pretty predictable, what's happening today. And we're not going to be able to solve this, just as General Petraeus told our committee last fall, through a military solution. There is no military solution. The solution is the Iraqis are going to have to come together with some political accommodation, getting towards some high ground of political reconciliation. We can help them, but we can't do it for them. And the longer we stay there, the more we dig ourselves deeper into a quagmire that will be more and more difficult to get out, making the Iraqis more dependent on us.
You say this is predictable, that there's no military solution. You were very tough on President Bush last year when he announced the troop surge. And I want to play a clip from when you spoke to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice during a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing in January 2007.
Madam Secretary, that I think this speech given last night by this president represents the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam.
Do you believe, Senator Hagel, that time will prove you were right about the surge? Do you still believe it was a dangerous blunder?
Well, I do, and I think what we're seeing today is further evidence of that. You know, Jane, it is not for me to decide whether I'm right or wrong. I take no pleasure or gratification in the fact that I asked some tough questions and was concerned along with others over the last few years. I'm an American. We're all Americans. We want America to succeed. But when we're talking about committing young men and women to an ultimate sacrifice that many have made, over 4,000 now dead and almost 30,000 wounded, we must have a policy worthy of those sacrifices, and we have never had that policy worthy of them. And I do believe it is the biggest blunder since Vietnam, because what it's done, aside from ruining our Army, doing great damage to our Marines, stretching us to a point we've never seen since World War II, undermining our interest in the world, undermining our standing in the world, putting $12 to $13 billion a month in Iraq, plus we have another real war in Afghanistan. When you add all that up, it has taken tremendous flexibility and latitude away from our foreign policy options. And when you add all that up, which you have to, because these are not situations that can be dealt with in vacuums. They are part of one. It's a big blunder in every way.
So then moving forward, John McCain says we should stay the course in Iraq and that we can only pull out when the situation stabilizes there. Both Senators Obama and Clinton say if they become president, they will start to pull out troops, 1 to 2 brigades a month. Which plan is closer to your position?
Well, whoever the eventual Democratic nominee is, just as will be the situation with John McCain, the two nominees are going to have to come to the American people and lay out in some detail, far better than what they have said so far, versus generally will stay the course versus we have to get out. That's not good enough. That's not a responsible answer. The fact is we know, according to our generals, for example, that we cannot sustain the rate of redeployments in Iraq. We're doing great damage to our force structure, where we're now finding that we were 10 to 15,000 captains short, 15,000 senior enlisted short, our recruitment retention's down. So we've got to find a way. The next president's going to have to find a way to unwind our military involvement in Iraq. Can't be done overnight. That would be irresponsible. Even logistically, you couldn't do it. For example, I think what I would propose, again, is going back to the Baker-Hamilton report of a year and a half ago. There were 76 recommendations in there. I think each of those recommendations had merit. Some of them are outdated. But, for example, engage Iran, engage Syria, start framing up and institutionalizing a Middle East security structure with the neighbors. These are the things that we're going to have to start doing to use all of the instruments of power, not just military power, because we can't sustain this. We're on a treadmill here that can't be sustained. And the American people have already turned the corner on this. We know that. And the next president is going to have to deal with that reality.
Let me turn to the economy for a moment. Republicans, including John McCain, have been focusing a lot on Iraq. Are they focusing on the wrong issue? Is it the economy, stupid, at this point?
Well, the economy obviously is a huge part of not just the current set of challenges that face our country and will always be a part of the equation. But we've got to broaden our...
Apparently, we have lost the senator's line to New York City. We are speaking with Senator Chuck Hagel. His new book is called America, Our Next Chapter, Tough Questions, Straight Answers. Senator Hagel, are you back with us?
Yes.
Sorry, for some reason,
yes,
we lost the line. So pick up where you would, please, where you left off as far as the economy being the issue here as we head into the 08 election.
Well, I don't know where you lost me on the economy, and I will certainly repeat what I said. I don't
you know
want to cover the same ground.
Let me pick it up here by asking you about, you're okay, on the banking committee. And
yes,
today, the front page of the New York Times, Senator McCain warned against a vigorous government action to solve the deepening mortgage crisis, saying that it's not the duty of the government to bail out or reward those who have acted irresponsibly, whether they're big banks or small borrowers. And I wonder if you agree with that.
Well, generally, I do agree with that. At the same time, it's always a matter of striking a balance. What is not only the obligation responsibility of government, but what can government do to help people who got into these things in many ways, not necessarily through their own fault? We've got to find a way to work our way through a situation that the markets will, in fact, work through in a self-correction process, and that's partly what we're going through now. We have to, in my opinion, be very, very cautious about overreacting, overregulating, overstimulating, getting the government too deeply involved in these things, because what we do here in whatever action we take, we set some precedents here. And I think McCain is right, generally, that it's not the obligation of the government to take care of these things. At the same time, there is a role for government in this, and that's what we'll be debating as we come back into session next week. What is the appropriate role of government? Monetary policy is very important here. What the Fed's Federal Reserve's done, I think, is right.
Let me cut you off there, Senator, and start with you next round. America, Our Next Chapter is Senator Chuck Hagel's new book. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Much more to come. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Senator Chuck Hagel about the war, the economy, and America's future. His new book is America, Our Next Chapter. This book, Senator, is part memoir, part public policy prescription. You seem to be very precise and have a very distinct vision for where you want this country to go. And I'm wondering, from your own experience growing up in the heartland of this country, where and when those big ideas started.
Well, Jane, as you know, each of us is a product of our environment, our experience, our upbringing. And it all factors in to our process that we use to not just accumulate and process information, but it focuses and frames us, and it develops a process as to how we come to conclusions and judgments and perspectives. And certainly I'm not unlike anyone else. That has happened to me over the years. And when you talk about some precision on focus in the book, I hope so, because I do believe that we are at one of these great transformational times in the history of mankind. And I know all of us in politics are a bit prone to hyperbole and overstatement. I know you'll find that shocking, but nonetheless, I do think it's not an overstatement to say we are living through this great transformational time. And the politics that go with that reflects these new challenges. And there's a reorientation in America and the world, I think, in the political world. We just mirror what's going on in the larger world. So when I talk about some of these specific things, economy, energy, environment, entitlements, taxes, my core premise is that not only are we at a transformational time that we must realize, but we have to frame these great challenges up and solutions for them in a 21st century framework that doesn't disconnect from where we've been and what we've learned in the last 50 years, but builds on to the foundations that we have done very well with over 250 years. But understand, this is a new world.
Let me ask you about that. You talk about a transitional time and a 21st century framework. In your book, you talk about the need for a shakeup in our political system during this mm-hmm. very transformational period, as you say. And let me read a quote from it. You say, there are watershed political years, such as 1994, 1980, 1968, 1932, 1854. They all had one thing in common. The political party in power was thrown out because the people saw it as irrelevant and incapable of leading America. We are living at such a time, end quote. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that your party at this point is irrelevant, not capable of leading America forward?
No, what I'm saying is that both parties, if you measure through our most significant tangible measurements we have as to where we are today in this country, starting with the plurality of registered voters are independents. They're not Republicans. They're not Democrats. Republicans are losing tremendous numbers of registered voters in this country. They're not going to the Democratic Party. They're going to park essentially off the freeway, and they are now independents. Second, last week's Gallup poll question, is America going in the right direction or the wrong direction? 81% of Americans last week in this poll, historical high, said America was going in the wrong direction. Historically and continued historically low job approval ratings for Congress, for the political parties, for the president. Now, I'll stop there and make this observation. That tells me one thing, that the American people have lost trust and confidence in its political system and leadership because we've become in many ways irrelevant to fixing the problems that this country faces. So in Washington today, we're captive to a political paralysis. We can't move. Now, whether that's
let me ask you this, Senator. Is your decision to leave the Senate a protest against the GOP or the state of the Republican Party today?
Oh, no. No, I said before I was elected and the day after I was elected in 1996 that 12 years was enough, two terms enough. It is for me, not everybody. That's everyone's choice. No, it has nothing to do with that. I'm not in any way discouraged about this country, and I think if you read that book, you'll get that sense. I say it pretty straight that I think this country's in some trouble. But I don't think there's anything that is so big we can't get out of. And the political system is critically important because it is the self-correction mechanism of a democracy. That's what elections are about. And there'll be some manifestation for all of this and from this. There'll be consequences, just like those elections that I mentioned in the book. Whether that means a legitimate independent candidate for president in 4 years, whether it's a new party or a different kind of party, this is a different world, and we are working our way through those differences, and how that comes out, I don't know. In 20, 25 years, we'll probably be going through something similar.
Let's go to the phones now, Senator Hagel. A lot of callers would like to join this conversation. Paul is first up in Milton, Massachusetts. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane, and Senator Hagel, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
Followed your career. One question I have, if given the opportunity and asked to be the running mate for either party, say Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or John McCain, would you consider running with any of those three candidates as a vice presidential candidate?
Paul, thank you. Senator Hagel?
Thank you. I've said that I don't intend to be a candidate for any office this year. I don't intend to be in government next year. So I think that would be my answer.
Well, why didn't you run for president? As I recall, at one point you were thinking about it, and there was even a press conference where it looked like you might make an announcement. What happened?
I did think very seriously about it. I thought seriously about a third term, even though I said that when I was elected and before I was elected that 12 years was enough. But it's like everything in life, Jane, at least which worked for me this way. You've got to take all the factors and look at them. For example, my wife and I have two teenagers in high school. These are important years, and I would have had to been away from home a year and a half to raise money and do the things that you've got to do. That's one thing. I just didn't think the time was right for me to do this. I had a number of things I wanted to finish up in the Senate. I've got two major bills that I'm co-sponsoring. One is reforming the GI Bill of Rights with Jim Webb. Another is with Chris Dodd, a new infrastructure bank. I hope that we could actually get these things accomplished this year. I wanted to write this book, which took me a lot of time. I would have had to walk away from so many of those kinds of things and the representation of my state. It just wasn't the right time for me to do this for those reasons and other reasons.
And yet, as you look at the field right now, those running, is there any part of you that wishes just for a moment that you might have had a chance?
No, not at all. I have not looked back on this decision with any regret at all. It was the right thing for my family, the right thing for me. The three individuals that we will choose from, certainly the Democratic side is not clear yet, but The three that we know that we will have to select a president are all capable. They are individuals who can lead, but there is one common denominator here, and I hope all three understand this, that whichever is elected president, they're going to have to find a new center of gravity of consensus to govern this country, and that means reach out to the other party. That means govern this country with some consensus, because it's just too dangerous if we allow ourselves to float and stumble and ricochet from crisis to crisis as we've been doing the last 8 years for another 4 years. It will put this country in a big, big hole.
You say all the candidates are capable of service. You are an influential Republican senator. Your fellow Republican senator, John McCain, is a friend. I know you've described him as a good friend. Why haven't you endorsed him for president?
Well, for me, when I endorse someone, at least the way I interpret it,
meaningful. When I endorse someone, I work for them, I get behind them, I do everything I can not to hurt them, but
to help them. John and I have some pretty serious disagreements on Iraq, the future forward in Iraq, on foreign policy, and I want to hear more of what John has to say about how he sees the next 4 years unwinding in Iraq, our involvement, our foreign policy, how the larger scope of the wider lens view of the world comes into play. I want to understand that better than I do now. And to be fair to John, he's been consumed with the primaries and getting the nomination. He will talk about these things, I know, in the general election as we clear that up and the Democrats pick their nominee. I want to hear the Democrat nominee. So that's essentially why I haven't endorsed John yet.
Back to the phones now. In Lincoln, Massachusetts, Sam is on the line. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As a voter, I feel pretty despondent that the government is just off the rails, is not responding to the will of the people at all. And I was very dismayed about the Iraq War Resolution vote. I'm someone who remembers the Vietnam War and how that whole fiasco went off the rails. And here was a situation that was much, much clearer. I mean, we didn't know about the lies of Gulf of Tonkin until years later. But here we knew it was right in front of us that this was a war, this was a rush to war. I remember listening to your colleague, Mr. Byrd from West Virginia, and the people just left him out on the clothesline to dry. No one was listening. He was pleading with people, what's the rush? We have the inspectors. What is the hurry? And I just don't understand why the Senate has given up control of the power to decree and decide when we should go to war. Mm-hmm. And it's very upsetting to me. I just feel it's way, way out of control. And I'm just wondering, as a senator, how you feel about it, that this mm-hmm. is a constitutional issue. It was the Senate. It was the representatives of the people who were supposed to make acts of war. And very upset about this. I thought we would have learned something from Vietnam, and here it is, and we go right back into the same ridiculous mess,
Sam,
costing us lives and treasure.
Thank you so much for your call. Senator, you actually voted in favor of the war authorization in 2002.
I did. And let me respond to your caller, and I will respond to your point about my vote. Your caller is right, and if he cares to look at my book, and I, of course, hope he does, and you've seen it, Jane, you know that I have two very specific chapters on Iraq. And one of those chapters is entitled, Where Was the Congress? And it makes the point exactly as the last caller has made it. And I've said many times over the last few years, and it means that I've not been very popular with this White House, with my own Republican Party, that the Congress has abdicated its responsibilities over the last 8 years. I think we're bringing that back. But no, we were absent. And we do, all of us, share some responsibility for this. And there's no question that the caller's point is exactly right. We are Article 1 of the Constitution. That doesn't mean we're better or bigger. We, as every schoolboy and girl knows, we have a government that includes three co-equal branches of government. But we have a responsibility to Congress to help set foreign policy as well. Now, as to my vote, I go into great detail in my book as to why I voted the way I did, and I'll be very brief here. Leading up to that vote in October of 2002, I was probably the most critical Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, asking, and I think it's all on the record, the most critical, toughest questions about why and where. I was assured by this administration, including the president and everybody in it, that this was a last option, that we were working through the United Nations. Your last caller made it exactly right, the point, when he talked about the inspectors. I was one who said in open hearings, on the record, in speeches, let's let the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors stay in there. They're the only ones that know really what's going on. And I gave a speech on the floor of the Senate a day before that vote, in which I voted for the resolution authorizing the President of the United States the power, if he needs it, to use military force. And I said in that speech, and it's been recorded, and people, a lot of people have seen it, all the doubts I had about this vote. But in the end, I gave my vote to the President because I thought in the end it was important that the world see a unified country here, being assured by the President and others that they were a long way from making any decisions, which we now know that's not true. And the caller was exactly right. All the signs were there. And I remember going on a Sunday morning show in August of 2002 after the Vice President of the United States, Vice President Cheney, gave a speech to the VFW at their annual convention. It was a straight-out war speech. And I remember calling Colin Powell and Condi Rice and saying, what's going on? The Vice President just gave a war speech. I was assured no decisions have been made. Now, I take responsibility for my vote. I said it in the book, if I had that vote to do all over again, I would vote against it.
I want to play a clip, fast forward, these 5-6 years later. Vice President Dick Cheney speaking with ABC's Martha Raddatz earlier this week. He was asked about the death toll of soldiers in Iraq reaching 4,000. Here it is.
The president carries the biggest burden, obviously. He's the one who has to make the decision to commit young Americans. But we are fortunate to have a group of men and women, all volunteer force, who voluntarily put on the uniform and go in harm's way for the rest of us.
Senator Hagel, do you agree with Vice President Cheney that President Bush, quote, carries the biggest burden?
Well, certainly a president of the United States carries a burden anytime you commit forces anywhere, knowing that you will have casualties. But you know, there is a credibility gap here, at least a little bit, with the vice president as far as I'm concerned. Here's a guy who got 5 deferments during the Vietnam War, has said publicly that that didn't work into his plans. There's a chapter in my book, which you might recall. It's entitled, Who Speaks for the Rifleman? We in Washington, whether it's the president, a senator, a vice president, we love to deal in abstractions, and we deal in abstractions of war. Let's send 3 brigades to Baghdad. Let's have 30,000 more troops in Baghdad for the surge. There are consequences with that, and it's always pushing it down to the poor guy at the bottom who carries a rifle, who has to do the fighting and the dying. Now over 4,000 who have died and their families. When I was asked the other day on one of the Sunday morning shows about the so-called military tactical success of the surge, I said, well, you might want to ask the families of over 900 Americans killed during that time how successful they think it's been. It seems to me we have to balance the realities of the consequences of war far more than we have.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about America's standing in the world with one of the country's leading foreign policy voices, Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. His new book is America, Our Next Chapter. You tell the story in the book, Senator, about serving in Vietnam with your brother Tom. And I wish for you to take us back to that time, to that experience, and the parallels you see in your own service with those young men and women serving today in Iraq.
Well, obviously, the world is different from every perspective. We know that. But still, when young men and women are put in positions in a war, these are people today who I think generally are far better qualified than we were in Vietnam in the sense of their training, their equipment, their leadership. These are all voluntary forces that have volunteered to serve their country versus mainly draftees in Vietnam. So those are some of the differences. But the fact is war is a very dirty business, and we always need to understand that. That doesn't mean that we should somehow drift toward a pacifist nation. Military strength obviously is critical. The security of a nation is the highest order and highest responsibility of any government. But it was a different time when my brother Tom and I served in 1968 in Vietnam, different situations. And those are the differences. The similarities I don't think ever change, regardless of the war, regardless of the time, regardless of the motives, the standards. That is, we are all human, and we respond in human ways. And the death of colleagues, the death of comrades, and what it does to families, what it does to units, it never changes either. And I think, Jane, in many ways we have lost a certain human dynamic in this very impersonal world, this very immediate, technologically driven world. And it's easy to dismiss war in terms of more clinical evaluations versus the down and dirty of what war produces. And that never changes. And that's why I wrote the chapter in the book about who speaks for the rifleman, because I don't hear many people talking about that, and especially because we've disconnected our society, Jane, with war. One last point before your question on this. Most Americans don't think much about the fact that we are asking less than 1% of the American population to do all the fighting, all the dying, carry all the burden, make all the sacrifices for our military. Now, you could say, well, they wanted to do that. They're volunteers. That's true. But what we're finding now is that as this continues, these two wars, 7 and 6 year wars, we're finding a breakdown in that. And that's another part of the book that I address.
You were asked recently in an interview if you were especially sensitive about making wartime decisions in your capacity as a senator because you've been to war. And you said that when you got to Vietnam, you were a rifleman, a private, as low as you can get, you said. I saw friends wounded and killed in front of me. And you went on to say that your experience was different from John McCain's or John Kerry's. And so I guess my question is, were you suggesting in some way that John McCain's perception or perspectives on Iraq would be different if he had been on the ground fighting like you were? Certainly he's a war hero. Certainly he served as a prisoner. You know, he's a prisoner of war in Vietnam. But would his perception be different based on your comments if he had had a different experience?
Well, first of all, I never challenge not only a colleague's experience or motivations, but anyone who served this country deserves great respect. And certainly someone like John McCain, who spent 5.5 years as a prisoner of war and not only served his country as a hero there, but in the service that he gave his country leading up to. There's no question about that. So that I want to make sure that that's very, very clear. I say the same thing about John Kerry. Anybody who put the uniform on of this country and went to combat somewhere somehow deserves respect. That's it. Now, to your bigger point, perspectives are important. And I'm not and wasn't attempting to in any way try to minimize anyone's service because they flew Navy planes and dropped bombs. That somehow didn't equate to understanding the ugliness of war. But what my perspective is and came from as a result of my experience on the ground for 12 months and seeing what I saw is what I relate to. And I don't try to at all frame it in a context of my experience was more significant or better or more worthy than anyone else's. Not at all. I can only speak for myself, and that's what that book says. And I do think that when people are on the ground, like my brother Tom and I were and others, who have got to go door-to-door like these young people are in Baghdad and other places and kick these doors down and are always on the edge of who is going to shoot them in the back or in the neck or an IED hitting them or whatever, that brings a certain perspective to war that people who've not gone through that can't have. And that was my point.
Let's go back to the phones now to Waban, Massachusetts, and Leon, who's on the line. Leon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jane.
Hello.
Senator, I'm a little concerned about something. During the Korean War, General MacArthur disagreed with President Truman on strategy and voiced his opinion, and he was quickly gone from the scene. Today, it seems like every general is politicized. They make decisions. They talk about political... They're politicizing the war, and at one point when President Bush was asked what was going to happen in this current war, he said, well, I'm going to leave that up to General Petraeus. Now, something's gone awry here. They serve the country as generals, and when they start politicizing their positions, these wars get prolonged.
Leon, thank you. Senator?
Well, Leon, if I may call you Leon, I think your observation is a very important one. I met for an hour and a half on Monday with Admiral Fallon, who you know tendered his resignation last week as Central Command Commander, the superior officer, matter of fact, to General Petraeus. There's been a lot made in the press about was he fired? Was this another Truman MacArthur kind of thing? Did he disagree? So on. And I'm not going to violate the confidence of that conversation with Admiral Fallon. He's been rather direct on what he has said about what he thinks we should be doing in the way of engaging Iran and other ways to deal with some of these issues. But I think your point is a very, very important point. Certainly no American that I know of questions the constitutional role of the civilian elected leaders in this country having the responsibility to make the last policy decisions on all affairs, including military, and the military is subservient to that. And I think we all agree on that. But also military leaders owe their commander-in-chief, the president, and this country, their best military thinking, not their best political thinking, but their best military thinking. Now, that's going to incorporate some dynamic of politics. It shouldn't be politics in this country, but politics certainly in Iraq or governance in Iraq. And I think you're correct. I think we have drifted a little too far in many of our senior officers not giving the best advice based on what they think, even though it's even though they would disagree with the Secretary of Defense or the President of the United States. That said, I think we have an amazingly competent set of senior officers in this country, as well as military, maybe the best military we've ever had. But we have to be careful with your point, and you're right.
Leon, thanks so much for your call. David now is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. David, welcome. Hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Senator. You mentioned General Fallon. I think he's a man who knows what he's talking about. He's gone. Eric Shinseki, General Shinseki, knew what he was talking about. Gone. You mentioned the WMD experts. Knew what they were talking about. Gone. People have been trying to alert Bush to the reality of global warming. Ignored for 8 years. There's been a intense sort of anti-intellectual, anti-expert culture in the Bush administration. And I'm wondering, Senator, if you think it's a product of the personality of George Bush or Dick Cheney, or whether there's something inherent in American conservatism that rejects expert opinion because it gets in the way of what corporations and what a certain segment of the country wants.
David, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Senator?
Well, that's a good point. And I don't know if it has anything to do with a conservatism that's anti-intellectual. I mean, you can take conservatives like George Will and Pat Buchanan and the late William F. Buckley. Two of those three were pretty adamantly and had been opposed to our involvement in Iraq, for example. I think, though, what it is about as much as anything else is this administration has never reached out to the Congress. It has never built a consensus of governance. I say in my book, one of the reasons that we blundered into Iraq, in my opinion, was the arrogance and ignorance of this administration, understanding the history, the culture of the Middle East. We were warned by all of our Middle Eastern allies across the board not to do this. But there was a certain arrogance there connected to an ignorance that they were hell-bent on going to war. And so you mentioned General Shinseki, and I think most of us understand what happened to General Shinseki, who I think is one of the finest officers we've ever had. When he was honest, he's the kind of officer I was talking about as your caller, when he was asked a question and testifying before an open Senate committee, he gave an honest answer. And because he gave an honest answer, not a political answer, he essentially was hounded out and derided and fired from his job of Chief of Staff of the United States Army. So I think it's more this current administration versus any kind of political philosophy that's led us into some of these problems.
Back to the phones now. Carl is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, welcome. You're on the line with Senator Hagel.
Hi, thank you, Senator, for your for your service to the country. First off, I from what I'm understanding from you and from everything I've ever heard from you, you notice that there's a big need for change in this country politically, and you understand this. And I believe that me as a supporter, independent supporter of Barack Obama, that. He would really, really could use your endorsement, and I would love to see you as vice president on his ticket, because it seems like you are two men that are like-minded when it comes to the direction of this country and also the blunder of this war. And thank you again for your service.
Carl, thank you.
Well,
Senator.
All I can say is thank you.
Well, the caller seems to suggest that you agree more with Barack Obama than you do even with John McCain in your own party.
Well, it obviously depends on issues. I'm, and have been, and my record is pretty consistent on this, I think a very legitimate conservative Republican. My voting record for 12 years is based on that. There are a lot of differences I have with Barack Obama.
Well, you also mentioned in the book a lot of similarities, and you mentioned that you and the senator introduced legislation to curb nuclear proliferation, among other things. I wonder what your experience was working with him on this and other issues.
First of all, I like him. He's very smart. And as I said at the top of this show, all three of these candidates for president are competent and smart people. No one knows how someone will be as a president of the United States. We don't have schools for presidential training. But all three certainly are smart enough to do the job. But specifically on Obama, he and I have teamed up on a number of things. I like working with him. I like him personally. He's very capable and he's very able. And what I was saying earlier, where I have disagreements with certain candidates, and none of us, I don't believe, ever agree totally with any one leader on every issue. But what you've got to do is put the big issues in a framework where you can get up above the smaller issues on a direction for the country. And that's partly why I wrote this book. And then bring some consensus and some compromise to moving the country forward to deal with these great challenges. And I hope that all three of these candidates understand that. I think they do.
What's the biggest issue moving forward, not just for this upcoming presidential election, but for the country over the next 4 years, the next 8 years? What's the biggest single issue you think faces our future moving forward?
I think bringing a consensus of governance together to address and solve these challenges, because if that does not occur, then we will be incapable of solving these great issues that face this country. These issues that face our country today, these new challenges and threats, are all capable of being dealt with. We have the resources to do this. And the issue is going to be whether we're wise enough to be able to harness those and bring a country together. That doesn't mean we don't have debates on issues. We must have debates on issues. That's democracy. But we've got to, in the end, bring a consensus first and foremost that puts this country first, not the Republican Party first or the Democratic Party first or anyone else. That's the biggest challenge facing America.
Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. His new book is America, Our Next Chapter, Tough Questions, Straight Answers. Senator, thanks so much for your time this hour. Very interesting. Appreciate it so much.
Jane, thank you.
You can link to an excerpt of Senator Hagel's book and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.